Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
Good afternoon. It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station, broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where it's currently 39 degrees under sunny skies. And we've already reached our high temperature. We're looking at west winds to 40 miles per hour. Should be decreasing to 30 this afternoon, but could gust as high as 55. Isolated snow showers tonight after midnight. Mostly clear sky tonight in the early evening, then becoming mostly cloudy with a low around 27 tonight overnight. Southwest winds to 15 miles per hour. Could gust as high as 20 tonight. Scattered snow showers tomorrow, mainly afternoon, but we're also looking for some sunny skies tomorrow as well with a high near 38. Coming up on the Midday News, cross-border watershed monitoring program has wrapped up, but not everyone thinks the work is all done. That and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Senate Judiciary Committee is advancing the nomination of President Biden's pick for Attorney General. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports Judge Merrick Garland could be confirmed by the full Senate later this week.
Then-Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell helped block Merrick Garland's Supreme Court bid 5 years ago, but McConnell has signaled he will support Garland to lead the Justice Department. Seven Republicans voted against Garland at the Senate Judiciary Committee. Garland told lawmakers last month he would give up his lifetime federal judgeship because serving as Attorney General will be the highest and best use of his skills in public service. Garland helped prosecute the Oklahoma City bomber, and he has long experience in confronting domestic terrorism. Garland says the investigation of the Capitol riot on January 6 would be his top priority at Justice. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Nearly 4 million doses of a new vaccine for COVID-19 are being shipped out across the nation this week. The single-dose shot developed by Johnson & Johnson was authorized for emergency use over the weekend and will be the country's third approved vaccine. NPR's Rob Stein reports the stepped-up effort comes as the number of new daily cases have leveled off at extremely high rates in the U.S.
CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says she is deeply concerned about the apparent reversal in progress in fighting the pandemic. The latest data shows that the 7-day average of new infections has increased by 2% a day to more than 67,000 a day. Deaths are also up by 2% to nearly 2,000 deaths per day. Both trends stand in contrast to several weeks of rapid decline in infections and deaths. Dr. Walensky says she's alarmed that states are starting to do things like lift mask mandates and restrictions on restaurants when the virus is still infecting and killing so many people. Rob Stein, NPR News.
The Biden administration has announced that migrant children separated from their families by immigration enforcement at the border will be able to reunify in the United States. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says it will take time to build out of the, quote, depths of cruelty established during the Trump administration.
When I started 27 days ago, I learned that we did not have the facilities available or equipped to administer the humanitarian laws that our Congress passed years ago. We did not have the personnel, policies, procedures, or training to administer those laws. Quite frankly, the entire system was gutted.
Mayorkas says the government is also working to explore lawful pathways to allow the families to stay in the United States. This is NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento, Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
The Kodiak Area Emergency Operations Center has reported low numbers of COVID-19 infections for last month. One new travel-related case was reported on Saturday, and no new cases have been reported for today. This brings the current case count to 1,061 cases since the start of the pandemic, with three cases classified as active locally. There have been 42 hospitalizations and five deaths associated with COVID-19 to date. There are no current active COVID hospitalizations. A cross-border watershed monitoring program has wrapped up, with Alaska and BC regulators concluding the project had run its course. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, tribes and scientists say there's still work to be done.
The Taku, Stikine, and Yunak are significant salmon-producing rivers. These fisheries are a key subsistence food source for Southeast Alaskans, and they're prized for the cash value for commercial and charter fleets. In 2015, Governor Walker signed a landmark agreement with British Columbia, pledging to study and monitor these transboundary watersheds that host a booming Canadian mining sector and Alaska's fisheries. That monitoring effort didn't get off the ground until 2017, and now Alaska and BC governments say their work is done. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation project manager Terry Lomax says the state developed valuable partnerships with British Columbia, but now there are other entities doing the monitoring, including the U.S. Geological Service.
So we did not want to be duplicative and want to truly just be efficient with all the resources. Didn't feel like it was necessary for multiple agencies to be collecting the same thing.
And it's the same story on the other side of the border, too. Greg Tamblyn heads BC's Environment Ministry's Regional Water Quality Section in Smithers.
Because these established sampling programs in the region, continuation of the joint sampling program would really be redundant.
Their final report says that 2 years of data found that water quality standards weren't exceeded on Alaska's side of the border. It found times when certain heavy metals were over limits in sediment, but noted there's a lot of naturally occurring minerals in the region. But scientists who've studied these watersheds say a couple of years is a blink of an eye for dynamic river systems.
You can't measure a given site once or twice a year for 2 years and claim that you know the baseline watershed health of that area.
Chris Sargent is a freshwater ecologist with the University of Montana's Flathead Lake Biological Station. The final report noted there was little evidence of contamination and aquatic life appeared healthy. But Sargent says many of the mines that Alaskans downstream are worried about haven't been built yet.
You know, the way I look at this is we have a lot of potential mines coming down the pike that are very large projects that could be built in the near future. And so I'm looking at like, well, do we know what these metal patterns look like right now in these rivers in case those big projects are built and things change? And I just don't think we're set up for success to answer that question yet.
It was Southeast Alaska tribes that helped spur the Walker administration to engage BC over transboundary mining. And they say the work has been short-lived. Fred Olson Jr. heads the 15 Tribes Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission.
We definitely need water quality sampling, but we need ongoing, seasonal, sustainable sampling. We don't need a couple years of hit and miss, cherry picking the data, and then saying everything's okay.
But Alaska and BC will still collaborate. Its bilateral working group, established during the Walker administration, will continue to meet twice a year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The legislature must decide this year whether to engage in unplanned spending from the Alaska Permanent Fund for the first time. Some lawmakers are raising concerns that once the state starts unplanned spending of billions of dollars, it won't stop until there are no fund earnings left. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The legislature faces a familiar problem. For the seventh straight year since oil prices plummeted, Alaska's state government is spending more than it's taking in. But there's a new issue. There isn't enough left in the piggy bank the state has used for decades to cover deficits to pay even the roughly $1,000 permanent fund dividends Alaskans received last year. Some, most prominently Governor Mike Dunleavy, have called for spending much more from the permanent fund than the state planned. He wants the state to follow the formula in a 1982 state law to pay out nearly $5,000 in permanent fund dividends. That amount would cover this year's dividend, plus the amount that wasn't paid out last year under the traditional formula. Dunleavy explained why in a short video posted on social media late last year.
I couldn't think of a better time to file the PFD law. I couldn't think of a better time for Alaskans to get $5,000. This pandemic has done a lot of damage in Alaska, across this country, across this world.
The governor has proposed drawing it from permanent fund earnings, the traditional source for PFDs. But that means the state would take more than $6 billion from permanent fund earnings this year. That's much more than is outlined in a law passed 3 years ago intended to limit draws from fund earnings and save enough to allow the fund to keep growing. Angela Rodell is responsible for overseeing how the fund is invested as the executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. She notes that the corporation's board supports a predictable draw, which is based on what's known as the percent of market value, or POMV. And if the state spends more than what the law says it should this year, she's concerned that it won't stop.
And so, yes, I do worry that if we don't follow a POMV spending rule, it will open floodgates.
Rodell notes that the annual draw to the state is now paying for the majority of state spending that the legislature controls. She adds that there could be short-term benefits from increasing state spending to help the economy.
And yet, I wonder, what are we creating for ourselves in 3, 4, 5 years, in 10 years? And do we have a place for your 2-year-old or your 5-year-old to grow up in? So we really have to ask ourselves, what do we want Alaska to be?
Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman wants the legislature to make changes this year to bring the budget into balance over the next 2 or 3 years. Without changes, he sees a scenario where the state will have high taxes in the future and no dividends.
You know, do you want to have 2 or 3 good years of big dividends and then no dividends for your grandkids? I think not. You know, this generation has been very, very fortunate. We've rode through the oil boom for the last 40 years, reaped enormous amounts of wealth and benefits. Let's leave some of it for our kids.
Stebbins says spending down the permanent fund's earnings would force the fund to take fewer investment risks, which would limit its growth and hurt it in the long run.
They won't know what the legislature is going to do in any given year. Therefore, they're forced into a very liquid position. It is a foolish, foolish thing to do.
Like Rodell, Stedman is concerned that once the legislature starts spending more than is planned, it won't stop until there's nothing left in fund earnings. He says that if that happens, lawmakers may then consider amending the state constitution to spend from the permanent fund's constitutionally protected principle.
Once the legislature basically kicks the door in, it's going to be a lot easier the following year. And then within a couple of years, they won't even think about it.
There is one factor that could make the budget less painful this year: the amount the state is receiving from the federal government in pandemic relief. The Senate Finance Committee will be examining the size of the state's annual future deficits in upcoming hearings. Dunleavy's administration has estimated their size as roughly $1 billion. But experts say that without major changes, that amount would be closer to $2 billion. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Over the weekend, Juneau city officials warned of the potential for historic avalanches, prompting a voluntary evacuation of one downtown neighborhood. Most residents stayed with relatives or friends in town, but a few spent Saturday night at Centennial Hall, where the city and the Red Cross set up an evacuation center. KTOO's Jennifer Pemberton has the story.
Heavy, wet snow, a kind of slush, was falling in Juneau on Saturday night. It's the kind of snow you can hear hitting the ground with a splash. And it's really hard to shovel. It's like lifting a couple gallons of water. It wasn't much better at the top of Mount Juneau, where the same wet concrete snow was piling up on top of this winter's very unstable snowpack. Juneau's urban avalanche forecast was for extreme danger on Saturday. That's a 5 on a scale that goes to 5. The city's emergency manager, Tom Matisse, said it was the first time he'd ever forecasted an extreme avalanche condition for Juneau. It was also the first time since 2008 that the city recommended that people in the Barrons Avenue neighborhood near downtown evacuate their homes. The Barrons Avenue avalanche path runs down Mount Juneau on the side facing Gastineau Channel near Juneau Douglas High School. It's obvious where the path is, especially in summer when you can see a distinct lack of trees. At the bottom of the path is 3 rows of houses.
I knocked on 39 doors today, a couple more on the edges of the avalanche path, but that's how many houses I knocked on and logged in my record.
I talked to Tom Matisse at the city's evacuation center on Saturday night. He said most people are staying at friends' houses or hotels.
There are several people that had motorhomes or boats and a lot of people with relatives in town. And so we wanted to make sure that we had people that had an option.
So the city teamed up with the Red Cross and opened up Centennial Hall. Only a few people registered to stay overnight, but it's busy with volunteers. One of the ballrooms is set up with about 6 white tents, each with a few cots inside, so families can stay together and spread out from other groups of people, both for privacy and COVID-19 safety. Michelle Brown is a Juneau City employee and a Red Cross volunteer.
You can see the little tent. We've got a wool blanket. We've got a fleece blanket. We've got pillows in there for folks. So we're set up to be able to help with the whole situation if it comes to that.
2 officers with Juneau Animal Control are here, too, so that people can bring their pets with them or even drop them off if they need to stay somewhere their pets can't. They have a few cat carriers and some leashes at the ready. Jordan Bales is one of the animal control officers.
What we're offering is, you know, holding people's animals for up to 10 days if need be, free of charge.
No pets are here yet, but someone stopped by earlier to say his cat had run away in the avalanche zone. They filed a lost pet report for him and are hopeful the cat will be found. The next day, the avalanche advisory was high, but no longer extreme, and there didn't end up being any slides in the Barrons Avenue area. The forecast for Sunday was for colder temperatures and less precipitation, so even though conditions were right for large avalanches, Matisse wrote in his report that, quote, "We may have dodged a bullet for the time being on the big one." For now, that top layer of new snow, called the storm slab, doesn't seem like it's going to come down. It's deep enough, though, that an avalanche would reach the houses at the bottom of the avalanche path. And underneath that storm slab is a deeper layer of snow from earlier in the year called the persistent weak layer. If that layer slid down the hill with everything on top of it, that avalanche would go all the way past the houses and Glacier Avenue and down to Gastineau Channel. And that persistent weak layer of snow is still there. And Matisse says it's there under the snow throughout the entire region.
This year is going to be dangerous, and this year is going to be spooky, and it may not end until all the snow is gone in the spring.
On Sunday, Matisse went up the Dan Moeller Trail on Douglas Island. He said he saw what he called 30 to 100-year avalanches, meaning really big ones, the kinds that snap off branches and knock whole trees down. There's still significant danger in the backcountry and in urban areas, and there's more rain and snow in the forecast for this week. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
After a frigid 18-hour trek, Dempsey Woods has claimed victory in the Taupuck 120 sled dog race. Named for late musher Elmer Taupuck Haworth Sr., the 120-mile race starts in Kotzebue, then loops in Noatak before coming back. KOTZ's Wesley Early has more.
Temperatures hovered around 20 degrees below as 3 mushers set out from Kotzebue Saturday afternoon. Woods, Kevin Hansen, and Jerry McCall. Jim Borkwin withdrew from the race hours before the start in Kotzebue. Woods, who eventually won, says he and Hansen swapped places at the head of the pack for most of the race.
Our speed was equal, you know, and then whoever was faster just get in front instead of trying to pass each other all the time and just, you know, you just waste time like that.
Hansen arrived in Noatak at 5:22 p.m. Woods was a minute behind, with McCall arriving just before 6 p.m. After a six-hour layover in Noatak, Hansen and Woods left before 11:30 p.m. on Saturday. Woods pulled ahead early Sunday morning, but he says Hansen was hot on his trail.
I started seeing Kevin, you know, just when I was about to reach Lockhart, I started seeing his light. So it was fun. We had fun the whole way.
Woods kept his lead into Kotzebue, where he arrived at roughly 6:23 a.m. Sunday morning. His final race time was 18 hours, 23 minutes. This is his second win in a row after claiming victory in last year's Tuckpuck 120.
Awesome. I think we're doing pretty good with the team.
Hansen would arrive at roughly 6:55 a.m., claiming second place. McCall, who left Noatak just before midnight, arrived in Kotzebue at 8:12 a.m. The three mushers will split a $10,000 purse. The Kobuk 440 Racing Association, the group that put on the race, will hold an award ceremony Monday evening at 7 p.m. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Wesley Early.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Eating fish can literally save lives. More after this.
Halibut and black cod buyers and sellers, simplify your sales online from one location at the Seafood Auction. Visit seafoodauction.net.
Premature birth is the leading cause of death for children under 5 years old worldwide, accounting for nearly 1 million deaths annually. Eating seafood or marine oils can significantly reduce that number. The life-saving ingredient? Omega-3 fatty acids. That's the main finding of a Cochrane review of 70 studies worldwide that included nearly 20,000 pregnant women. It showed that omegas from marine sources reduces early premature birth by a whopping 42%.
The effect really has to be strong in order to see it in a Cochrane review. I am very impressed that it has come out as significant as it has.
Dr. Tom Brenna is a professor of pediatrics, chemistry, and nutrition at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas. Research on marine omega-3s and pregnancy has been going on since at least 1992, he says. Brenna calls the formal medical collaboration and conclusions in the Cochrane Review a blunt instrument.
The number of studies and the number of women studied is large enough so that it is very difficult to imagine that future studies, no matter how they come out, are going to affect these results.
Premature babies are at higher risk of a range of long-term conditions, including developmental delay, learning difficulties, and visual impairment. Brenna says marine-based omega-3s also improve those problems.
Many of us believe that omega-3s are important for continuing development of the neural system and of the eye.
Brenna says a challenge now is to translate the research findings on preventing premature births and other positives into health policy and wider educational outreach.
I think we have a major effect here that ought to be heralded from the rooftops.
Find links at AlaskaFishRadio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your messenger for Monday. It is the first day of March, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 8:03. It will set again at 6:43, giving us 10 hours and 40 minutes of glorious daylight. That would be a gain of 4 minutes and 58 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this day was 2, set in 36, and our record high was 49, set in 1985. We're closer to the latter. It's 39 degrees right now, and we're looking for sunny skies for this afternoon, but isolated snow showers tonight after 1 a.m. Mostly clear skies will turn to mostly cloudy skies overnight with a low of about 27 tonight. Southwest wind to 25 miles per hour should decrease to 15 after midnight. Looking at our local district tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 3:18 p.m. That will be a 9.2-foot tide. followed by a low tide at 9:29 this evening, a minus 0.8 feet. And our next high tide in the middle of the night will be at 3:49 a.m. and be 9.3 feet. And our low tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will be at 9:56 a.m. and be minus 0.2 feet. Over on the west side, and these are Uganic Pass tides, you have a high tide coming up at 3:50 this afternoon. That will be a 16.8-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:06 p.m. of minus 2.24 feet. Your next high tide will be at 4:14 a.m. and be 17 feet. And your low tide for tomorrow morning on the east side, on the west side, rather, will be at 10:31 a.m. and be minus 1.4 feet. Mariners, here is your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 986 millibar low 40 nautical miles northwest of Kodiak City will move to 40 nautical miles southeast of Cordova and go to 979 millibars. It will then move inland by Monday night and dissipate. Its front will move across the Gulf through Monday night. A 979 millibar Bering Sea low will enter the western Gulf Tuesday afternoon, then move to the North Pacific and go to 330 nautical miles southeast of Kodiak Island and 982 millibars by Wednesday morning. Its front will move across the Gulf of Alaska through Wednesday morning. Result not too good. Marmot Island to Sitkanat, gale warning today. West wind to 40 knots right now and seas to 19 feet. For tonight, west wind to 30 knots, seas coming down to 17 feet. And for tomorrow on the east side, west wind to 25 knots will go to southwest 15, seas 16 feet. Over on the west side in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tonight. West wind to 30 knots right now, seas to 8 feet, and freezing spray right now in the Shelikof. For tonight, southwest 25, seas to 6 feet. And for tomorrow, southwest 15, becoming northeast tomorrow afternoon in the Shelikof, seas to 3 feet, will build to 5 feet tomorrow afternoon. And for Tuesday night in the Shelikof, north winds to 25 knots, seas to 7 feet. Inside waters, Chiniac and Marmot Bays, gale warning today in Chiniac Bay. We have southwest winds to 35 knots, should come down to the west in 25 knots this afternoon. Seas 7 feet, subsiding to 4 feet this afternoon. For tonight, southwest 15, diminishing to 10 after midnight, seas to 2 feet. For tomorrow in Chiniac Bay, variable 10, seas to 1 foot, building to 3 feet tomorrow afternoon. In Marmot Bay, small craft advisory today, southwest 30 right now and seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, look for southwest 10 in the morning, becoming variable less than 10, seas to 3 feet in Marmot Bay. There will be a Board of Education special meeting and work session on Monday. That's tonight at 6:30 p.m. at the District Services Conference Room F140 in the old high school wing. The meeting will also be streamed through BlueJeans. Meeting login information is posted on the Kodiak Island Borough School District website under the Board of Education tab. And for tonight, they'll be discussing certificated leaves of absence and certificated contracts. Tomorrow, the Board of Education will be having a special meeting also at it'll be happening at 12 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room, the same room, F-140 of the old high school wing. It will also be streamed through BlueJeans, and you want to go to the Kodiak Island Borough School District website for login information. And tomorrow they'll be discussing the FY22 preliminary budget presentation and going into executive session regarding the FY22 budget. But again, that's tomorrow at 12 p.m., room F-140. The Kodiak Public Library Association Board of Directors will hold its monthly meeting tomorrow. That's happening at 5:30 p.m. via Zoom. This meeting is open to the public. Please email them for a link if you'd like to attend online and just go to the Kodiak Public Library Association website. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session tomorrow in the Kodiak Public Library at 12 p.m. Immediately following the work session, the City Council will hold a special meeting. Both meetings are open to the public. Agendas and web streaming links for these meetings are available at the City of Kodiak website. For additional information, call the City Clerk at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council and Kodiak Borough Assembly will hold a joint work session on Wednesday. This meeting will begin at 6:30 p.m. and be held in the Bayside Volunteer Fire Station at 4606 East Razanoff Drive. The meeting is open to the public. Agenda and web streaming links for the joint work session are available at the City of Kodiak website. For more information, call the City Clerk's Office at 486-8636. Kodiak Island Trails Network Kodiak Outdoor Film Festival is back. Your Kodiak Outdoor Adventure Film submissions are due March 5th for the March 12th Kodiak Fairground Drive-In Film Festival. Films can be dropped off on a thumb drive at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Salmon Reception Desk. Contact Philip with questions or to meet you at the door at 486-1871 and visit islandtrails.org/film for complete guidelines. Poetry readings will be held monthly through April by the Kodiak Public Library. Join them on Zoom to hear local friends read favorite poetry. Contact Ani to share a poem and be part of this event. The next reading will be Wednesday, March 17th at 6 p.m. The library offers home delivery for those unable to get out of the house and curbside pickup at the side door. Call the library for this service, available Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. And the library is also open by appointment for in-person visits Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m., 1 p.m., 3 p.m., and 5 p.m., and Friday through Saturday at 11 p.m., 1 p.m., and 3 p.m., for 90-minute visits per day. All must wear masks and follow social distancing guidelines. For information about these things, call the library at 486-8686.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.